CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor with Professor Serhii Plokhii. His exciting, thrilling, challenging, amazing new book is Nuclear Folly, A History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The world started again on October 27th. By October 28th, the perception in Washington is that Jack Kennedy has won. The perception in Moscow is Nikita Khrushchev to rationalize. Well, I've made them promise they won't invade the island, so we've saved Cuba. Well, I've got the missiles out of Turkey. But Malinovsky, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, their equivalent, general in chief, and other voices at the presidium, that would be Mr. Kosygin and Mr. Brezhnev, do not believe that it's a success. But that will wait two more years before Khrushchev is removed in a coup in the presidium. Right now, we have to deal with Khrushchev rationalizing what's happening. He can. He does. He calls it a success to guarantee Cuba. But at no point, as the professor indicated, has he consulted with Fidel Castro, the passionate young man who is now in charge of an island where there are still nuclear-tipped missiles, tactical missiles, IL-28 bombers capable of carrying nuclear warheads, nuclear warheads parked in one particular ship tied up in Cuba. Castro is in charge of all of this. Professor, Khrushchev did not pay attention to Castro. He then realizes that Castro is going to be a problem. He turns to Mikoyan and asks him to solve this. Mikoyan, again, is the hero. Does Mikoyan at this point, does he feel vindicated? Does he feel put upon? He's got family problems.
Well, Castro believes that he's going down. So he sends a letter to Khrushchev advocating the nuclear attack by the Soviet Union on the United States. So in all this crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev are really, really frightened of the possibility of the nuclear war. Castro is the one who at some point is actually pushing for the nuclear strike because he believes that he has actually nothing to lose anymore. And his revolution is perceived, especially from the perspective of what we know today, as a communist revolution. In reality, it wasn't for a long period of time. It was a revolution which was nationalist, anti-colonial, in which for Castro, it was a major insult coming from Moscow that someone decided what will happen with Cuba without consultations with him. So from that point of view, at that moment, Khrushchev for Castro was not better than was either Kennedy or Eisenhower because they didn't respect the sovereignty, the independence of Cuba. And from that point on, Castro decides actually to do everything in his power to make it difficult, if not impossible, for Khrushchev and Kennedy to reach the deal. The instrument that he has in his hands is allow or not allow the inspectors, American inspectors or UN inspectors, on Cuban territory to see whether the Soviet missiles actually were removed. And he plays this card to its fullest, refusing to cave in, refusing to agree for any kind of visits or inspections on Cuban territory. And eventually, as you said, Khrushchev dispatches Mikoyan there. Mikoyan leaving dying wife behind in Moscow. But Khrushchev tells him, okay, no one can do that by you. This is your duty as a communist, as a leader of the country. And Mikoyan goes there. His wife, of course, dies when he is in Cuba. He refuses to come back despite the fact that Khrushchev allows him to do that. And he negotiates with Castro. It's very difficult kind of negotiations. At some point, Castro tells him, okay, if you don't want to protect us, you can leave. We'll be fighting on our own. And he requests that the Soviets would turn under the Cuban command the tactical nuclear weapons that the world doesn't know yet about, the U.S. doesn't know yet about, and would not learn until the end of the of the Cold War. So there is a possibility of another conflict over Cuba, something that is not part of the traditional narrative of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the so-called crisis of November, as opposed to crisis or the missiles of October.
The Washington leadership demands that the Soviets offer an ability to validate that the missiles have been withdrawn. Castro makes it impossible to validate that on Cuban soil. You thought the acting Secretary General of the United Nations has turned back, though he offers his offices. Mikoyan negotiates and negotiates. Is it Khrushchev's threat that I'll withdraw all Soviet troops that moves Castro? Does that what makes Castro decide, realizing that if he's uncovered, the U.S. will attack him?
This is certainly a concern. This is the reason why he asks not only for the tactical nuclear weapons, but before that, he opposes to the idea of withdrawing the Soviet bombers. That became a sticking point, really, in relations between Moscow and Washington, because Kennedy demands to remove not only missiles, but also the bombers that were capable of delivering nuclear bombs. And eventually Khrushchev decides that, okay, he doesn't care anymore about Castro, about his image as the leader of the world revolution. He cares about his country, so he makes a decision to withdraw that, whether Castro likes that or not, whether he opposes to that or not. And later, Khrushchev pays price for this, basically neglecting Castro, because one thing that happens is that the Americans had to really check on whether missiles were leaving Cuba or not when the Soviet ships were already in the Atlantic. So it was a very humiliating for the Soviet military commanders procedure when they had to open their twin decks and show either to the American ships or to the American airplanes the missiles that they were bringing back to the Soviet Union. And the Minister of Defense would later say, when they would remove Khrushchev from power, he would say that never in history is the Russian army or the Soviet army suffered that kind of humiliation, as was the case during withdrawal from Cuba.
Lessons learned, Professor. We have a couple of minutes. The lessons learned that I've learned, I'll comment from what I've learned from your book, that poor communication between the leaders of nuclear-fueled states, poor communication is the risk in 1962, and it continues the risk today. That's what I've learned from you. What is a lesson learned for us today that you draw from this explication? We have about 2 minutes.
The communications has been improved on the one hand, but on the other hand, with cyber warfare, we actually are in a worse situation today than we were back in 1962, because the communications that you get, you can't guarantee anymore that those are the actually genuine communications. The second issue, which was there during the Cuban Missile Crisis and continues today, is that key decisions can be made at the end of the day, not by the leaders themselves, but by the people on the ground who act under very different conditions, have a very different sort of information. So when you get into the brinkmanship of any sort and think that you can actually deal with that, somehow precluded from escalating all the way to the conflict per se, one thing that the leaders forget about and don't account for is something that President Kennedy said, that there is always some SOB that doesn't get the message or acts on its own. And that human factor in it, in the sense of the factor that is not somewhere in Kremlin, not somewhere in the White House, is still with us here today. And one more thing that suggests to me that we are in a worse situation than we were back in 1962, that is the fact that the war was avoided back in 1962 because both Kennedy and Khrushchev were afraid of the nuclear war and nuclear weapons. I don't think that the new generation of leaders has that kind of fear.
The book is Nuclear Folly, A History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Serhii Plokhii is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.